Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Our theme song was performed by Joe Clement. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital and capitalism. On today's show, we'll be considering cops and crime, looking at some of the ways that the capitalist state enforces its power and some ways the rest of us can address those forces. Bill Resnick talks with Portland Mercury reporter and news editor Alex Zielinski about Portland policing. Desiree Helligers shares some audio from last month's community info session on Portland's involvement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The City Council will be voting on this Wednesday, February 13th, on whether to withdraw, again, from the JTTF. Then, Larry Bolden reviews Patricia Kullberg's historical novel of mid-20th century Portland, Girl in the River, about the virtues of breaking some laws. And Clayton Morgridge comments on capitalism as organized crime. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm, where you can also subscribe to the show. Those segment posts generally include additional information and links, so they're worth checking out. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Bill Resnick and Alex Zielinski talking about policing in Portland.
Alex Zielinski, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Alex Zielinski is the news editor of the Portland Mercury, a biweekly paper now, but 24 hours a day on the web for your latest entertainment and political issues. She spends a lot of time at City Hall reporting on police matters, social justice issues, homelessness. She's also written for Street Roots in Portland and in various other places as a journalist. Today we're going to talk about mostly about the police, their power, how they operate, their political views, and whether and how they can be controlled or at least influenced to operate within constitutional standards and indeed support constitutional government. The struggle to control the police is now going on everywhere in this country and indeed around the world. Let's go back to today in Portland that Alex Zielinski has reported on many, many, many different aspects of efforts to control the police. Alex, why don't we start with the Quanice Hayes police shooting and its aftermath and reverberations, then discuss the police and mayor in the recent neo-fascist marches and protests. How about Quanice Hayes? Tell us about that and Greg Lewis.
Yeah, well, we can start with some background as to the shooting in general. Quanice Hayes was a 17-year-old black teenager who in February 2017, just almost exactly 2 years ago, was shot by a police officer after this long series of events, 2 hours of committing a few petty thefts in a neighborhood using a fake handgun. He was on the police radar for those 2 hours. A couple folks called in. The police showed up, ended up chasing him down, found him eventually in this alcove next to a house and a garage where he couldn't really escape. They had him cornered, more or less. And he ended up being shot after police at the scene were kind of giving him mixed commands to come forward, to walk forward on his knees, to put his hands up while he was doing it. He reached down to pull up his pants from behind, which apparently were sagging. And officers believed he was going to reach for a gun. So at least one officer shot and killed him in the process.
This was after he pointed out, I can't keep my arms up and crawl at the same time.
Right. And the reason we're talking about it today, there's several reasons, but there was a report that just came out from an outside investigating team called the Office of Investigative Review that's based in California. And they gave their own analysis on how the police acted during the shooting in particular, ended up coming to the conclusion that the police involved could have acted much more intentionally and thoughtfully before firing on this kid 2 years ago. That a lot of times in these cases, we hear from police officers, you know, this was the only option. There was nothing else I could do. This was the last resort. And this investigation is kind of pushing back, and this report is pushing back on that sentiment by saying, well, you could have actually communicated a bit better with this kid. You could have protected yourself more. All the officers were pretty vulnerable. They didn't have shields. If they thought this guy had a gun, they should have been more secure. A lot of more technical kind of ways that they could have protected themselves, basically saying you didn't need to shoot this kid. And so that has raised some interesting conversations in City Hall. At the same time, we have this settlement agreement coming to the surface about one sergeant in particular who was not involved in the shooting, but several days after Quanice Hayes was shot, he made some quote-unquote joke during roll call, the central precinct, with a number of other officers present about shooting black people. Those statements have only been released very recently. There are about 11 different people who were present during that time who gave their kind of retelling of what this officer said. It all was around the same lines of what to do when you encounter a black person, you should shoot them. And it was in relation...
He said that. The other officers didn't. In fact, some of them actually reported him.
Well, the only reason that we know about this happening is that two officers decided that they should be telling City Hall and telling their superiors about this. Mm. As opposed to kind of just laughing and brushing it off. After the statement was made, shortly after Quanice Hayes' death, this sergeant in particular, his name was Greg Lewis, he was fired by the city. Of course, the Portland Police Association, which is the Portland Police Union, fired back, challenging that termination, which they're allowed to do, requested to go into arbitration with city government about this firing. And the decision made last week was to, instead of going into arbitration, was to allow the city to just give this sergeant back pay for the 2 years that he hasn't been working, allow him to retire, kind of erase this termination from his record, and essentially have him promise or guarantee that he will not ever go back to work for Portland
police. And it got $100,000. And because he had this contract of the police union with the city, is very, very tight about a lot of things, like police shootings. They have, before they're even interviewed by anybody else, they can see their lawyer. You have to wait 24 hours. There's all of these rules that ensure that the police have all of their stories straight, basically. The other part of the contract, of course, is like this arbitration stuff and the standards by which a cop can be disciplined. And then the arbitrators almost invariably rule for the police because
the standards are so narrow.
So narrow. The police union has sort of become a power unto itself. That is, there's sort of civilian authority, but really the DA, in fact, and the police have this complicated relationship of mutual dependence, and so the DA doesn't do anything about police shootings. In Portland, there have been a variety of quite questionable ones, and really nothing has happened. There's constant reports over the many years, we need better training, but nothing happens. And the police union is part of it because their duty is to protect the cops.
And it's good to also note that Portland is under a much larger settlement agreement with the Department of Justice based specifically on the way that its police force has handled shooting and use of force against people with mental illness, which, right, of course, overlaps with people of color. So that there's a lot of restrictions in place, or hypothetical restraints in place, that should be helping the city improve and helping the police force improve the way these interactions play out. But we're still kind of at a frustrating point where we aren't seeing that
It's not happening in practice. And they get into fights with people. Sometimes the people start them. Sometimes they just get out of hand, the police themselves. And what you have is this police force that's now very hard to control or discipline. This is Cable Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Alex Zielinski, who's a ace reporter and news editor of the Portland Mercury, and spends a lot of time in City Hall, particularly around police matters. Alex, we're talking about, can the police be controlled? We've just gone over one case where it shows that the police union is really quite powerful and can protect all sorts of terrible behavior. Let's talk about the recent clashes between the alt-right and a lot of protests by the left in Portland, which draws many, many more people to its demonstrations than the alt-right trying to get press. Tell us about that and the way the police has been operating.
Yeah, these clashes have taken place over a number of years now. And it seems after each of these protests, especially ones that end in arrest or, you know, heightened violence among different members of these groups and involving the police as well, that it's a moment for the mayor and the city to reconsider how it should be policing or how it should be restricting these kinds of protests, especially when they're targeting and hurting Portlanders more than anything. A lot of times the alt-right representatives in town are coming from Vancouver, Washington. They aren't Portlanders. They're just kind of coming to town to stir up a fight. I mean, it's impacting people who are part of these left-leaning groups that come out to counter protest these events. Now it's spreading fear in communities who don't want to have to interact with these more radical right-wing groups, that once they come to town and protest, they linger for a bit, and there's reports of them harassing people of color and specifically Muslim people on the streets.
They're very aggressive, these guys. They don't seem to have to worry about being arrested.
A lot of them are white men.
They're white men, yeah.
Who don't have to worry about that.
Yes, that's the story, isn't it? But that's it's the social end of the story. There's also the political end of the story. Mm-hmm. Wheeler decided at one point to propose a new set of rules with regard to protests,
right,
which empowers the police even more than they are now, much more. It gives them power over the police commissioner, power over all protests, the manner of protest, the time, the place, and he can forbid them too.
Right. Yeah. And to be fair, the time, place, and manner kind of rules around protests, the city council and the city is already allowed to, like, if a protest gets to a certain level of chaos, they are allowed to restrict them. They're in charge of public spaces. I mean, there are some rules which I think are important to have. What was unconstitutional specifically about this policy that the mayor introduced in November, I believe, was that these restrictions would be based on preconceived assumptions about what these groups are going to do, if they might come and spread hate speech or if they might come and try to be violent with people. And basing something on assumptions of perceptions of how a group might act is, even when they haven't done anything, that's not necessarily constitutional.
Yeah, although the critique of that went beyond that, it's that there are really ways of dealing with these conflicts are allowed and in fact should be used and are not by the Portland police and not demanded by the police commissioners of Portland or the police chief, which is sometimes they really should arrest some of these people who are the Proud Boys seem immunized from being arrested or even watched. Although they are being watched, the police are and the FBI are involved in watching the Antifa's, among others, quote, environmental terrorists and all the rest. At least they have observers at every rally, and there are certainly police photographing every rally. They know who the people are who, in fact, engage in fighting, and yet they have not stopped it. And then attack the left at many of these demonstrations, and for quite a long time, they see the left as their enemy. You found out that there's a little bit of butting up between the Proud Boys and...
There's a lot of proof that members of Patriot Prayer and the police have been in close communication since these protests have started happening in Portland. Text messages and calls between some of the top officers who are involved of setting up protests, which is common for those officers to have contact information for people who are in charge of any kind of protest or event. But it reflects that there's a healthy and supportive relationship kind of between some people within Patriot Prayer and the police. And those conversations aren't as easy to find or don't exist as much between left-leaning groups, which a lot of left-leaning groups are not eager to work with the police regardless. So it's a tricky comparison. But there is, you know, a lot of cooperation, I guess, between these right-wing kind of alt-right groups and the police.
Yeah. But it does show, at minimum, that the right wing is perfectly happy working with the police and is, in fact, nourishing that relationship and has good comradely sort of talk. In many other countries, that's also true. The police and the right wing are quite amicable with one another, and they have interests in common. That's sort of alarming. It would be to the left's benefit to deal with the police in different ways, confronting them, to be sure, particularly around police shootings and other sort of lesser violence, which the city is constantly paying people who sue for being injured by the police. Instead of going to trial, they settle it for $10,000, $30,000, whatever it is, in medical bills. Not much is happening on that front. The police are operating as they see fit. And it seems to me we have to confront that. There's no question about it. It does seem to me that we also have to try and keep the police constitutional, work with the ACLU and other groups that keep trying to put the pressure on. Alex Alinsky, news editor of the Mercury, knows a lot of police and all of the operations of the city and how it's all working. You have the last word, Alex.
I certainly think what members of the Portland community are doing to monitor the police goes beyond what other cities are doing. I think the police are realizing they're beginning to be held accountable. But the biggest roadblock, I believe, is these agreements and these contracts that are negotiated between the police union and the city. And the next time that will come up is next year. And so it'll be interesting to see how the city prepares by either strengthening its team of city attorneys that are on board with those negotiations, and if they'll actually crack down on discipline issues that they themselves have critiqued, even though that they agreed on them within this settlement. So stay tuned to see kind of how that next round plays out.
Alex Alinsky, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it.
What happens when you call the cops? Say what? This is what happens when you call the cops. Come on. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
I'm sick of people being victimized by criminal cops. Psychopathic predators terrorizing neighborhood blocks. Equipped with pepper spray, mace, cuffs, tasers, and glocks. They like serial killers acting out subliminal thoughts. Forget what you taught. These cops have got a license to kill. Witness intimidation means that they can use it at will. Code of silence means that the pigs will never let out a squeal. And if they go to court, they know the judge will make them a deal. For real, that's why they stopping me, locking me up and stopping me, confiscating my property, talking in my demography, making the poor commodities, profiting off of poverty, enforcing policies, supporting prison economies. Yeah, no one makes money when the violence stops. Hating brutality is the way to make a criminal crop. Blood in the gutters.
That was Rob Hussle with the classic reminder not to call the cops. And remember, if you see a houseless person, the number to call is 211, not 911. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Alex Alinsky of the Portland Mercury discussing policing here in Portland. I'm Fran Michel. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We come to you every Monday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. You'll be able to find a longer version of Bill Resnick's conversation with Alex Zielinski about the Portland police in a day or two on the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm. Next, we turn to audio from a January community info session on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, that agreement between local police and federal law enforcement. The Portland City Council will be voting this Wednesday on whether to continue or terminate that arrangement. This town hall features speakers from the ACLU, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, Casey Jama of Unite Oregon, and Jeff Selby of the Portland Japanese American Citizens League. It was recorded and edited by Desiree Helligers.
Kimberly McCullough, Legislative Director with ACLU.
ACLU of Oregon has been targeted not only by the FBI, but also by the Portland Police Bureau. I have files in my office that are like this thick from two different FOIA requests that we put in, where we, Freedom of Information Act requests, where we did public records requests to find out about investigation of our organization and found that they were collecting all sorts of information about us as if we somehow are a threat to our communities, which I find kind of ludicrous. It wasn't very long ago, it was about a year ago, that the FBI put out a notice that ended up causing a whole debacle at our State Department of Justice because they identified Black Lives Matter as a potential threat to public safety. But then later, there was a leaked memo where we found out that they had actually created a category of folks that they identified as Black identity extremists, and they identified them as a domestic terrorist threat, again, targeting Black Lives Matter, which we find really problematic. So, you know, our view is that the city should withdraw from this formal relationship with the JTTF. And that doesn't mean that if there was an actual threat to public safety in Portland, that there shouldn't be some sharing of information and some collaboration if there was an actual threat. But the difference would be that it would need to rise to the level where there actually is enough evidence that Portland police officers and the Portland Police Bureau can engage in investigations based on Oregon law, and where we don't have this veil of secrecy under how our officers are operating. Next, Joanna's going to speak next.
As you may know, I spent the last 18 months talking to people in every corner of the city of Portland. And one of the things that people mentioned over and over again is their sense of insecurity just walking the street in the city of Portland today. Because I have been, since Tom Potter was mayor, and he first made the decision to not join the Joint Terrorism Task Force, there's been a group that the ACLU has been a part of that we've been nonstop talking about the difference between feeling safe and protecting community members and then being over-policed and not really knowing what Portland police officers are doing every day that they're working with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So for example, the two Portland police officers who are assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, both of them, when they're not working at the FBI, work as part of the criminal intelligence unit. And so if you think about that, and I asked the FBI this because apparently it took 10 of them to come to my office to explain to me why it was important for us to stay in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. When I asked them about this, they said, oh, no, there's really clear lines between what they do with the FBI and what they do with the Portland Police Bureau. But if you're using the same data system to collect information on community members, and the police chief has no ability to supervise their day-to-day activities, that is the exact reason why Mayor Tom Potter in his day said no to joining the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And that is the reason why today I feel very uneasy knowing that we have city employees working for a federal government who has shown that they have targeted and will continue to target immigrants and refugees, African Americans, and other vulnerable populations. It is important for us as a city to be safe. Means what we need to do is know our neighbors. We need to make sure that we're reaching out to people who don't look like us, who don't speak our language, and building those community relations. We will never be safer with more armed people in our community. Now, I met with the FBI and their team recently, and this is what they told me that they're now focused on. Most of our work now is focused on white supremacists. I thought it was really interesting that they're trying to change their public message, right? Because they know the community is concerned about this rise in white supremacy. So now their public message is, oh no, we're just trying to protect people from white supremacy. It is important that we call it like it is. We are using city resources to fund an operation that we get no information on. We cannot feel safe if we cannot hold our police officers accountable for the work that they're doing. And in addition to that, we just don't know how much information the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force is collecting, what they're doing with the data that they're collecting, and how they're using that data to have impact on community members. What I am proposing through a resolution ACLU and other community partners have been working on is that we would identify the deputy chief as the person that the FBI would contact if there was a threat of terrorism or additional information that Portland Police Bureau should have. But there is no logical reason why we should continue to pay two Portland police officers full-time to be part of a federal organization that has shown that they are targeting people based on not criminal behavior, but based on what they look like, where they come from, and what language they speak.
Thank you so much for all of you for coming. My name is Casey Chama. I'm the executive director of Unite Oregon. So thank you all for coming. And I also want to especially thank Commissioner Hardesty's leadership on this issue and her staff who really brought us all this together. I also want to acknowledge there has been community organizations and coalition who has been working this issue for long, long time. Who have been, even though sometimes the political winds were against us, were there at the table and really engaging this issue, how do we protect our community from profiling? Our coalition is diverse, strong, includes ACLU, NAACP, JLC, Cab Watch, and many, many other organizations that I won't mention because the list is very long. Unite Oregon, when we started, came out of it when two organizations merged, what used to be called Center for Intercultural Organizing and what used to be called Oregon Action. The organization at the time I was leading was called Center for Intercultural Organizing. That organization was founded after 9/11. And the whole issue of we start to engage at the beginning was that to address issues of Islamophobia in our community. And then later became full-fledged social justice immigrant refugee rights organization. So I'm familiar with this issue because it's held close to my heart. I'm a Muslim man who lives in this community. And I want my city to assure me that my presence in this city matters. I'm welcome and I'm protected by profiling. But I also want to extend that invitation to every single person who might be profiled, whether they are our people of color, African American community, Native American community, homelessness community, houseless communities, LGBTQ community. We need to make sure that when we say we are building equity, we mean we equity for all, not some, but for all. This issue of JTTF, there's a national movement. This is not only issued in Portland. There's a civil rights Muslim organizations who are addressing this issue, who have been engaged, including CARE, who have been engaged in this issue for many years. And the conclusion is very clear that FBI is profiling Muslim community. That's a national issue. That's a national conversation that's happening. When we create hysteria and fear among our community, we create a place where community members are fearful from the people in position of power, from their neighbors, from their within each other, if they even come from the same community, from the system, the government that they're supposed to trust to protect them. We have sanctuary law. And to their credit, in 2000, I believe when during the Bush administration, when Attorney General Ashcroft decided he wants to interview Muslim men from certain countries, our police chief at the time cited our Oregon sanctuary law and said, I cannot do that because it's against Oregon law. We also have Oregon laws that also ensures that we don't target people based on their religion, race, gender, sexual orientation. United Oregon and with the ACLU worked it hard to pass HB 2002, which really states very simple language that no law enforcement agency should target an individual for suspicion of violation or provision of law based solely on their real perceived factor of the individual's age, race, ethnicity, color, national origin, language, gender identity, sexual orientation, political affiliation, religion, homelessness, or disability. We wanted to make sure that everyone in our community is protected. So, with that said, Commissioner Harris and also Kimberly said, ICE is part of the JTTF. How in the world are we gonna work and send our police officers sitting at the table with ICE, an agency who are literally separating children from their parents? How are we gonna allow to be sitting at the same table and agencies who are putting cages on children? How are we gonna allow to collaborate an agency that violating the civil liberties of immigrant and refugee community members? My dear Portlanders, we are in crossroads in this country. The direction we go as a community, as the city, will determine what kind of community we want to build. We need to ensure that as we are going to crossroads and difficult time, that we need to bridge, not to break bridges.
My name is Jeff Selby, and I'm speaking tonight as a Nikkei community member. Nikkei is the term that we as Japanese Americans call ourselves in the United States. I'm a former two-term president of the Portland Japanese American Citizens League. So it's a new year, 2019. And we once again find ourselves discussing the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. I'm representing the Nikkei community tonight to share our long-standing belief that the city's involvement with the JTTF will not keep Portlanders safer, but will rather harm many of us as a result of racial profiling and the targeting of our Arab and Muslim families and friends. When social justice activists and racial equity practitioners take on the challenges we face today, we know it's vital to remember our history. We look back in order to move forward. The history of the Nikkei community is unique, and it's important to remind all Portlanders of how the events of 1941 played out in our own community. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th, 1941, and by 2:30 that afternoon, the FBI stormed Portland's Japanese American neighborhood and arrested 110 individuals. They rounded up community leaders, businessmen, doctors, journalists, Buddhist priests, and Japanese language teachers. And although none were charged with any crimes, they were incarcerated at the Multnomah County and Rocky Butte jails. The arrest happened so quickly because the FBI had profiled the Nikkei community, and the government classified our family members as a national security threat solely based on their ancestry. On February 19, 1942, President Roosevelt signed and issued Executive Order 9066, which allowed the government to forcibly remove 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry from their homes and ship them off to incarceration camps in desolate areas of the country. We are fortunate that we still have Nikkei elders in our community like George Nakata and Henry Sakamoto, who can remind us of their experiences in the camps. Henry testified before City Council in 2011 to remind us all how fear and profiling led to a gross violation of our civil rights. Some have said that these atrocities happened so long ago and that we should move on. Native Americans, people of color, immigrants, and other marginalized communities are often told by dominant culture to get over things like genocide, slavery, and incarceration. But to ignore our history is to marginalize the experience of our underrepresented Portlanders. In 1941, the FBI targeted my community. Since then, they have targeted Arab and Muslim Portlanders and labeled what they call black identity extremists and what we call Black Lives Matter as a security threat. The Nikkei community is using our current privilege and our history to bring light to this issue. We have been on record since 2005 opposing Portland's involvement with JTTF. Being part of the JTTF does not make Portlanders safer. It takes our police officers away from community policing and places them in the position of possibly violating innocent Portlanders' civil rights and state law. Thank you.
You've been listening to voices from the January 16th town hall on Portland's involvement in the Joint Terrorism Task Force and the FBI's history of targeting communities of color in Portland. This coming Wednesday at 2 p.m. at City Hall, there will be a vote on a proposal to withdraw Portland from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Again, that's Wednesday at 2 p.m. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm in the United Police States of America. It used to be known as the land of the free. I'm in the United Police States of America.
That was audio from the January Town Hall on Portland's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which you can weigh in on at City Council meeting this Wednesday at 2 p.m. at City Hall in Portland, Oregon. It might be of interest to know also that the FBI recently was revealed to have classified those in fervent support of abortion rights as terrorists, even though it's only those on the anti-choice side who have actually assassinated doctors and bombed clinics. A link to that story and more information about all our segments can be found on the KBOO website in a day or two when we post the show on the Old Mole Variety Hour pages at kboo.fm. Now, we turn to Larry Bolden with a review of the highly praised novel Girl in the River about life in Portland before Roe v. Wade. Larry?
Good morning. It is with great pleasure that I talk to you this morning about a splendid novel by a good friend and fellow Old Mole, Patricia Kohlberg. I'm not sure how this novel slipped by me in 2015, but it did. While at lunch with another Portland feminist and leftist, Johanna Brenner, in the course of our conversation, Johanna asked, "Have you read Patsy's novel?" No, I was ashamed to say I had not, and could not really recall it ever being mentioned to me. The novel is Girl in the River, and besides being a rich historical novel about Portland and about the work of one particular Portland woman, it is a wonderfully told story. Since I knew Patricia had been a physician and medical director for Multnomah County Health Department, I expected her novel to be well-researched and historically significant. What I did not quite expect was how totally captivating her story would be and how convincing and well-fleshed out her characters are. Her main characters are Maybelline, also known as May Rose, May's dear friend Trudy, and Dr. Ruth Barnett. Although Patricia hastens to tell the reader that her characters are fictitious and the story a product of her imagination, there can be no doubt that Dr. Barnett is modeled on a real woman, a woman who helped hundreds of women terminate their pregnancies. For many years, Dr. Barnett maintained her clinic under, quote, "a long-standing arrangement between the legal establishment and the abortionists. So long as no woman died, the law looked the other way, and no patient of Ruth Barnett's had ever died. She was the best. Everyone knew it, from the mayor to the street sweeper," close quote. May comes to know Dr. Barnett because she and Trudy are very sought-after prostitutes who are very much a part of the high society of Portland, and Dr. Barnett is also a well-known part of that high society. May's mother ran a boarding house in a small town in Portland, and May is her do-everything helper. She helps in the kitchen, cleans the rooms, and looks after her hard-working mother. When May's mother, Lily, dies quite young, quote, "a man with pressed shirt and clean nails showed up at the Rose home for mill hands and lumberjacks. He'd come to take possession not of May, but of her home. He was from the bank and had papers to prove they owned it," close quote. For a time, she turns to a man she already knows for help. She went to live with Dr. Goshorn and his six striplings, unquote. Fortunately for May, she is able to extricate herself quickly from that slave-like situation and soon finds herself on the streets of Portland with no money and no real means of employment. She is soon arrested for vagrancy, the catch-all charge used to incarcerate the poor and the jobless. She finds herself in Rocky Butte Jail without bail or any likelihood of freedom. Already an avid reader, she's hopeful when she hears that, quote, Rocky Butte had a library. May, picturing the colossal wood-paneled room of the library downtown with stacks and stacks of books, had been excited until she surveyed what the jail had. 5 copies of the Holy Bible, 2 guides for reading it, several manuals on household crafts, half of which May could have written herself, a couple dozen novels like Little Women and Pollyanna, and several issues each of Dime Detective and Screen Book, dog-eared and torn up. Without giving up too much of the story, suffice it to say that May is eventually rescued by a woman named Trudy, who admits to May that she's a prostitute, and counsels May to avoid pimps at all costs, and suggests that May go into business with her under the protection of a madam. May decided maybe she didn't mind the big bucks and being her own boss, the fun and the glamour. She liked being admired. She didn't give a hoot about being loved, not by a man. Close quote. May and Trudy have quite a good life together and genuinely love each other, though Trudy always seems to want more from May than she can honestly give. The descriptions Patricia Kohlberg gives of Portland street life and the web of political and police corruption shine with authenticity, and she often quotes or paraphrases from news stories of the time, adding to the veracity of her story. Eventually, May wants out of prostitution, and she manages to talk Dr. Barnett into taking her on as an assistant. Certainly a big step down in income and in the luxuries of her daily life, but for the first time, she has work that is deeply meaningful to her and works for a woman she genuinely admires. This is a rich and wonderful story. Once I started it, I read it up in 2 days and felt in its thrall for many weeks later. I don't think I've done justice to the complexity of this tale nor the relationships that May has with both men and women, but I will close by quoting from the epilogue. Ruth Barnett continued to perform abortions after she was arrested and her clinic shut down in 1951. She never turned a blind eye to a woman in trouble. She was repeatedly arrested and hauled into court, but did not exhaust her legal appeals until 1967. At the age of 78 and suffering from malignant melanoma, she became the oldest woman ever sent to prison in Oregon. She was paroled 5 months later and died in 1969, less than 4 years before the landmark decision Roe v. Wade. Close quote. Writing this book was obviously a labor of love for Patricia, and it's been a labor of love for me to read it. We can only hope that she writes more fiction to go along with her many nonfiction articles and collaborations. I've been talking about Patricia Kohlberg's novel, Girl in the River. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was the Lunachicks with Fallopian Rhapsody. And before that, book mole Larry Bolden reviewing Patricia Kohlberg's novel, Girl in the River. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Finally today, we hear from Clayton Morgeridge about capitalism as organized crime. Clayton?
Thank you, Fran. Well, according to the ideology that passes for common sense in a capitalist society, there is a bright line between organized crime and legitimate business. But they're not really that different. Here's how Megan Day reveals their similarity in a piece a few days ago in Jacobin magazine. The mafia is famous for running protection rackets. This usually consists of a mobster sauntering up to an unsuspecting resident or shopkeeper, making thinly veiled threats of violence, and then offering peace and security for a fee. A person is just going about their business when a powerful entity barges in, simultaneously creating a problem and selling the solution. The result is hell for ordinary people, easy money for gangsters. You know who else does this? Capitalists. Here's an example. The pharmaceutical company Purdue started manufacturing OxyContin in 1996, claiming that it was non-addictive. For years, they knew that was a lie, but covered it up while pushing for reckless prescriptions and higher doses anyway. After millions of people did, in fact, become addicted to OxyContin, opening the door for many to use and become addicted to heroin, the company's board saw an opportunity. They started talking about expanding into the addiction treatment market to become an end-to-end pain provider. According to ProPublica, Purdue executives discussed how its sales force could promote Narcan, a drug used to treat overdoses, to the same doctors who prescribed the most opioids. Barge in, cause problem, sell solution, money in the bank. End of quote. If we are going to unmask capitalism as crime, we have to have a deeper understanding of crime than whatever the capitalist state defines as illegal. Here's a more philosophical conception of a criminal moral philosophy from Norman Bucklew, serving a life sentence for murder and armed robbery in Leavenworth. I'm a thief. I don't think robbing a bank is wrong. If I want to take the money in a bank, then I'm going to take it. And if you can catch me and put me in prison, I'm not going to sniffle about being in the pen. But don't try to tell me what I did was wrong. I don't respect the law because laws are for people who are weak and need them. If someone comes into my house and takes something, I'm not going to call a cop. I'm going to deal with it. And if I'm not man enough to get it back, then that guy has a right to take whatever he wants because I don't really deserve to own it. That's how society should be. The purely criminal perspective, then, is that you have a right to whatever you are strong enough to take and to hold on to. The only limit to the exercise of power is an opposing power. Now, life among people who lived like that would be a war of all against all, nasty, brutish, and short, as Thomas Hobbes pointed out over 300 years ago. How can you enjoy the things you have in your house when others are constantly trying to break in and take them? How can you go out to get more and leave what you have unprotected? And how can you even go to sleep at night? So the reasonable thing to do would be to agree on a set of laws and institutions for their enforcement to protect life and property. Instead of having to risk your life applying your own justice, you turn justice over to the state. You now have peaceful relations with your neighbors instead of war, because the state is now the only legitimate user of violent coercion. In this way, the category of crime comes into existence. Crime is the unlawful taking of things that belong to other people, whether their lives or their property. Without the state and its laws, nothing really belongs to anyone. So crime is now an intruder rather than the norm. But notice what has not been criminalized by the capitalist state. The unlimited accumulation by individuals and corporations of money, property, and political power. Crime has not really been pushed outside, it has just been organized. People like Norman Bucklew can carry on in peace with the same purpose as before, namely to take away as much as they can from each other, only now with the support of the state and its laws protecting private property. It is really only the state of war made polite. Each individual must still always be vigilant to avoid being evicted, fired, bankrupted, or addicted to some drug from Big Pharma for someone else's profit. There is no common commitment to the well-being of everyone. There is only the individual's commitment to him or herself, regardless of the impact of one's depredations on others. This is, in essence, a society organized for the flourishing of crime. Crime is the willingness to seize whatever one can get without consideration of the effect of that seizure on the lives of others. It is a refusal to cooperate and a willingness to rely on coercion and deception to get what one wants. In this sense, every large corporation is as criminal as Norman Bucklew and the Mafia. The only difference is in the degree to which they control the state and the media. Apologists for capitalism say we owe nothing to each other just because we are members of society. The basic norm of capitalist society is self-sufficiency, at least for those who are not wealthy enough to buy favors from the state. Now, most Americans, in fact, think they do have social responsibilities to the needs of others. But the doctrine of complete independence from others is a powerful idea in American thought, and it occasionally leaks out in unadulterated form. Some years ago, a Republican Treasury Secretary wondered aloud whether Social Security and Medicare are really necessary. Able-bodied adults, he said, should save enough on a regular basis so that they can provide for their own retirement and, for that matter, for their health and medical needs. Well, Republicans are still anxious to make cuts in Social Security and Medicare. According to Forbes magazine, the higher deficits caused by the Republican tax cut of 2017 will be used by political elites to call for cuts in government spending, and if they have their way, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will be on the table. This drive to diminish the help we all provide for all of us recalls Margaret Thatcher's infamous remark, "There's no such thing as society." And in a way, she was right. Capitalism isn't so much a society as it is an anti-society, a system of organized crime. A real society, a legitimate society, would instead be organized cooperation, society organized into forms of cooperation aimed at the full and free development of all its members. And that contradicts the fundamental principles of capitalism. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was The Coup with We Got the Guillotine. And before that, Clayton Morgeridge explaining how capitalism is organized crime. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I've been your host today, Fran Michelle. The multi-talented, multi-accomplished Patricia Kullberg has been our engineer. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Alex Zielinski of the Portland Mercury, for their conversation about the continuing bad news about the Portland police. You'll be able to find a longer version of Bill Resnick's conversation with Alex Zielinski in a day or two on the Old Mole Variety Hour page at KBOO-FM, with all of the segments of the show and additional information about them. Thanks to Desiree Helligers for recording and editing audio from the town hall on Portland's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The City Council will be considering that topic on Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m., February 13th, and you can join your neighbors there to participate in the conversation. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of the novel Girl in the River, and to Clayton Morgeridge for his commentary on capitalism as organized crime. Thanks to Denise Morris for additional editing. Thanks to you, KBOO listeners and members. Remember, if you're not a member yet, you can join by clicking on the Donate button at the top right of the webpage at kboo.fm or by coming down to the station at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon.
You can visit the Old Mole Variety Hour pages to subscribe or find shows and segments. The Mole will be back next Monday with more news, views, reviews, and interviews.